"Your milk," he said, adding, "Miss."
"I've got some money," Esk said. Granny had always told her, "Always be ready to pay and you won't have to. People always like you to feel good about them. It's all headology."
"No, wouldn't dream of it," said Skiller hastily. He leaned over the bar. "If you could see, your way clear to turning the rest back, though. Not much call for milk in these parts."
He sidled along a little way. Esk had leaned the staff against the bar while she drank her milk, and it was making him uncomfortable. Esk looked at him over a moustache of cream.
"I didn't turn it into milk. I just knew it would be milk because I wanted milk," she said. "What did you think it was?"
Beer.
Esk thought about this. She vaguely remembered trying beer once, and it had tasted sort of second hand. But she could recall something which everyone in Badass reckoned was much better than beer. It was one of Granny's most guarded recipes. It was good for you, because there was only fruit in it, plus lots of freezing and boiling and carefully testing of little drops with a lighted flame. Granny would put a very small spoonful in her milk if it was a really cold night. It had to be a wooden spoon, on account of what it did to metal. She concentrated. She could picture the taste in her mind, and with the little skills that she was beginning to accept but couldn't understand, she found she could take the taste apart into little coloured shapes. Skiller's thin wife came out of their back room to see why it had all gone so quiet, and he waved her into shocked silence as Esk stood swaying very slightly with her eyes closed and her lips moving. Little shapes that you didn't need went back into great pools of shapes, and then you found the extra ones you needed and put them together, and then there was a sort of hook thing which meant that they would turn anything suitable into something just like them, and then... Skiller turned very carefully and regarded the barrel behind him. The smell of the room had changed. He could feel the pure gold sweating gently out of that ancient woodwork. With some care, he took a small glass from his store under the counter and let a few splashes of the dark, golden liquid escape from the tap. He looked at it thoughtfully in the lamplight, turned the glass around methodically, sniffed it a few times, and tossed its contents back in one swallow. His face remained unchanged, although his eyes went moist and his throat wobbled somewhat. His wife and Esk watched him as a thin beading of sweat broke out on his forehead. 10 seconds passed, and he was obviously out to break some heroic record. There may have been steam curling out of his ears, but that could have been a rumour. His fingers drummed a strange tattoo on the bar top. At last he swallowed, appeared to reach a decision, turned solemnly to Esk and said,
"Kalish Gnish Sag..."
His brow wrinkled as he ran the sentence past his mind again and made a second attempt. He gave up. His wife snorted and took the glass out of his unprotesting hand. She sniffed it. She looked at the barrels, all 10 of them. She met his unsteady eye. In a private paradise for 2, they soundlessly calculated the selling price of 600 gallons of triple-distilled White Mountain Peach brandy and ran out of numbers. Mrs. Skiller was quicker on the uptake than her husband. She bent down and smiled at Esk, who was too tired to squint back. It wasn't a particularly good smile, because Mrs. Skiller didn't get much practice.
"How'd you get in here, little girl?"
she said, in a voice that suggested gingerbread cottages and the slamming of big stove doors.
"I got lost from Granny."
"And where's Granny now, dear?" Clang went the oven doors again,
and it was going to be a tough night for all wanderers in metaphorical forests.
"Just somewhere, I expect. Would you like to go to sleep in a big feather bed, all nice and warm?"
Esk looked at her gratefully. even while vaguely realizing that the woman had a face just like an eager ferret, and nodded.
You're right. It's going to take more than a passing woodchopper to sort this out.
Granny, meanwhile, was two streets away. She was also, by the standards of other people, lost. She would not see it like that. She knew where she was. It was just that everywhere else didn't. It has already been mentioned that it is much harder to detect a human mind than, say, the mind of a fox. The human mind, seeing this as some kind of a slur, wants to know why. This is why. Animal minds are simple and therefore sharp. Animals never spend time dividing experience into little bits and speculating about all the bits they've missed. The whole panoply of the universe has been neatly expressed to them as things to A. mate with, B. eat, C. run away from, and D. rocks. This frees the mind from unnecessary thoughts and gives it a cutting edge where it matters. Your normal animal, in fact, never tries to walk and chew gum at the same time. The average human, on the other hand, thinks about all sorts of things, around the clock, and on all sorts of levels, with interruptions from dozens of biological calendars and timepieces. There's thoughts about to be said, and private thoughts, and real thoughts, and thoughts about thoughts, and a whole gamut of subconscious thoughts. To a telepath, the human head is a din. It's a railway terminus with all the tannoys talking at once. It is a complete FM waveband, and some of those stations aren't reputable. They're outlawed pirates on forbidden seas who play late-night records with limbic lyrics. Granny, trying to locate Esk by mind magic alone, was trying to find a straw in a haystack. She was not succeeding, but enough blips of sense reached her through the heterodyne wails of a thousand brains all thinking at once to convince her that the world was, indeed, as silly as she'd always believed it was. She met Hilda at the corner of the street. She was carrying her broomstick, the better to conduct an aerial search. With great stealth, however, the men of Ahulan were right behind Stay Long Ointment, but drew the line at flying women. She was distraught.
"Not so much as a hint of her," said Granny.
"Have you been down to the river? She might have fallen in."
"Then she'd have just fallen out again. Anyway, she can swim. I think she's hiding, drat her."
"What are we going to do?"
Granny gave her a withering look.
"Hilda Goatfounder, I'm ashamed of you, acting like a cowin. Do I look worried?"
Hilda peered at her.
"You do, a bit. Your lips have gone all thin." "I'm just angry, that's all. Gypsies always come here for the fair. They might have taken her."
Granny was prepared to believe anything about city folk, but here she was on firmer ground.
"Then they're a lot dafter than I'd give them credit for," she snapped. "Look, she's got the staff."
"What good will that do?"
said Hilda, who was close to tears.
"I don't think you've understood anything I've told you," said Granny severely. "All we need to do is go back to your place and wait."
"What for?"
"The screams, or the bangs, or the fireballs, or whatever," Granny said vaguely.
"That's heartless."
"Oh, I expect they've got it coming to them. Come on, you go ahead and put the kettle on."
Hilda gave her a mystified look, then climbed on her broom and rose slowly and erratically into the shadows among the chimneys. If broomsticks were cars, this one would be a split-window Morris Minor. Granny watched her go, then stumped along the wet streets after her. She was determined that they wouldn't get her up on one of those things. Esk lay in the big, fluffy and slightly damp sheets of the spare bed in the attic room of the Riddle. She was tired, but couldn't sleep. The bed was too chilly, for one thing. She wondered uneasily if she dared try to warm it up, but thought better of it. She couldn't seem to get the hang of fire spells, no matter how carefully she experimented. They either didn't work at all, or worked only too well. The woods around the cottage were becoming treacherous with the holes left by disappearing fireballs.
At least if the wizardry thing didn't work, then Granny said she'd have a fine future as a privy builder, or well sinker. She turned over and tried to ignore the bed's faint smell of mushrooms. Then she reached out in the darkness until her hand found the staff, propped against the bedhead. Mrs. Skiller had been quite insistent about taking it downstairs, but Esk had hung on like grim death. It was the only thing in the world she was absolutely certain belonged to her. The varnished surface, with its strange carvings, felt oddly comforting. Esk went to sleep and dreamed bangles and strange packages and mountains. And distant stars above the mountains, and a cold desert where strange creatures lurched across the dry sand and stared at her through insect eyes. There was a creak on the stairs, then another, then a silence. The sort of choking, furry silence made by someone standing as still as possible. The door swung open. Skiller made a blacker shadow against the candlelight on the stairs, and there was a faintly whispered conversation before he tiptoed as silently as he could towards the bedhead. The staff slipped sideways as his first cautious grope dislodged it, but he caught it quickly and let his breath out very slowly. So he hardly had enough left to scream with when the staff moved in his hands. He felt the scaliness, the coil and muscle of it. Esk sat bolt upright in time to see Skiller roll backwards down the steep stair ladder, still flailing desperately at something quite invisible that coiled around his arms. There was another scream from below as he landed on his wife. The staff clattered to the floor and lay surrounded by a faint octarine glow. Esk got out of bed and padded across the floor. There was a terrible cursing. Sounded unhealthy. She peered around the door and looked down on the face of Mrs. Skiller.
"Give me that staff."
Esk reached down behind her and gripped the polished wood. "No," she said, "it's mine."
"It's not the right sort of thing for little girls," snapped the barman's wife.
"It belongs to me," said Esk,
and quietly closed the door. She listened for a moment to the muttering from below and tried to think of what to do next. Turning the couple into something would probably only cause a fuss, and anyway, she wasn't quite certain how to do it. The fact was, the magic only really worked when she wasn't thinking about it. Her mind seemed to get in the way. She padded across the room and pushed open the tiny window. The strange nighttime smells of civilization drifted in. The damp smell of the streets, the fragrance of garden flowers, the distant hint of an overloaded privy. There were wet tiles outside. As Skiller started back up the stairs, she pushed the staff out onto the roof and crawled after it, steadying herself on the carvings above the window. The roof dipped down to an outhouse, and she managed to stay at least vaguely upright as she half-slid, half-scrambled down the uneven tiles. A 6-foot drop onto a stack of old barrels, a quick scramble down the slippery wood, and she was trotting easily across the inn yard. As she kicked up the street mists, she could hear the sounds of arguments coming from the riddle. Skiller rushed past his wife and laid a hand on the tap of the nearest barrel. He paused and then wrenched it open. The smell of peach brandy filled the room, sharp as knives. He shut off the flow and relaxed.
"Afraid it would turn into something nasty?" asked his wife.
He nodded.
"If you hadn't been so clumsy," she began. "I tell you, it bit me." "You could have been a wizard and we wouldn't have to bother with all this. Have you got no ambition?"
Skiller shook his head.
"I reckon it takes more than a staff to make a wizard," he said. "Anyway, I heard where it said wizards aren't allowed to get married. They're not even allowed to..."
He hesitated.
"To what? Allowed to what?"
Skiller writhed.
"Well, you know, thing."
"I'm sure I don't know what you're talking about," said Mrs. Skiller briskly.
"No, I suppose not."
He followed her reluctantly out of the darkened barroom. It seemed to him
But perhaps wizards didn't have such a bad life at that.
He was proved right when the following morning revealed that the 10 barrels of peach brandy had indeed turned into something nasty. Esk wandered aimlessly through the grey streets until she reached Ahulin's tiny river docks. Broad, flat-bottomed barges bobbed gently against the wharfs, and one or two of them curled wisps of smoke from friendly stovepipes. Esk clambered easily onto the nearest and used the staff to lever up the oilcloth that covered most of it. A warm smell, a mixture of lanolin and midden, drifted up. The barge was laden with wool. It's silly to go to sleep on an unknown barge, not knowing what strange cliffs may be drifting past when you awake. Not knowing that bargees traditionally get an early start, setting out before the sun is barely up. Not knowing what new horizons might greet one on the morrow. You know that. Esk didn't. Esk awoke to the sound of someone whistling. She lay quite still, reeling the evening's events across her mind until she remembered why she was here, and then rolled over very carefully and raised the oilcloth a fraction. Here she was, then. But here had moved.
"This is what they call sailing, then?"
she said, watching the far bank glide past. "Doesn't seem very special." It didn't occur to her to start worrying. For the first 8 years of her life, the world had been a particularly boring place, and now that it was becoming interesting, Esk wasn't about to act ungrateful. The distant whistler was joined by a barking dog. Esk lay back in the wool and reached out until she found the animal's mind and borrowed it gently. From its inefficient and disorganized brain, she learnt that there were at least 4 people on this barge and many more on the others that were strung out in a line with it on the river. Some of them seemed to be children. She let the animal go and looked out at the scenery again for a long time. The barge was passing between high orange cliffs, now banded with so many colours of rock, it looked as though some hungry god had made the all-time record club sandwich, and tried to avoid the next thought. But it persisted, arriving in her mind like the unexpected limbo dancer under the lavatory door of life. Sooner or later she would have to go out. It wasn't her stomach that was the pressing point, but her bladder brooked no delay. Perhaps if she... The oilcloth over her head was pulled aside swiftly, and a big bearded head beamed down at her.
"Well, well," it said, "what have we here, then? A stowaway, yes, no?"
Esk gave it a stare.
"Yes," she said. There seemed no sense in denying it. "Could you help me out, please?"
"Aren't you afraid I shall throw you to the pike?" said the head.
It noticed her perplexed look.
"Big freshwater fish," it added helpfully. "Fast. Lot of teeth, pike."
The thought hadn't occurred to her at all.
"No," she said truthfully. "Why, will you?"
"No, not really. There's no need to be frightened."
"I'm not."
"Oh."
A brown arm appeared, attached to the head by the normal arrangements, and helped her out of her nest in the fleeces. Esk stood on the deck of the barge and looked around. The sky was bluer than a biscuit barrel, fitting neatly over a broad valley through which the river ran as sluggishly as a planning inquiry. Behind her, the ramtop still acted as a hitching rail for clouds, but they no longer dominated as they had done for as long as Esk had known them. Distance had eroded them.
"Where's this?"
she said, sniffing the new smells of swamp and sedge.
"The upper valley of the River Ankh," said her captor. "What do you think of it?"
Esk looked up and down the river. It was already much wider than it had been at Ahulin.
"I don't know. There's certainly a lot of it." "Is this your ship?"
"Boat," he corrected.
He was taller than her father, although not quite so old, and dressed like a gypsy. Most of his teeth had turned gold, but Esk decided it wasn't the time to ask why. He had the kind of real deep tan that rich people spent ages trying to achieve with expensive holidays and bits of tinfoil, when really all you need to do to obtain one is work your arse off in the open air every day. His brow crinkled.
"Yes, it's mine," he said, determined to regain the initiative. "And what are you doing on it, I would like to know? Running away from home, yes, no? If you were a boy, I'd say you were going to seek your fortune."
"Can't girls seek their fortune?"
"I think they're supposed to seek a boy with a fortune," said the man, and gave a 200-carat grin.
He extended a brown hand, heavy with rings. "Come and have some breakfast."
"I'd actually like to use your privy," she said.
His mouth dropped open.
"This is a barge, yes, no?"
"Yes."
"That means there's only the river."
He patted her hand.
"Don't worry," he said. "It's quite used to it."
Granny stood on the wharf, her boot tap, tap, tapping on the wood. The little man, who was the nearest thing O'Hoolan had to a dockmaster, was being treated to the full force of one of her stares and was visibly wilting. Her expression wasn't perhaps as vicious as Thumbscrew's, but it did seem to suggest that Thumbscrew's were a real possibility.
"They left before dawn, you say?" she said.
"Yes," he said. "I didn't know they weren't supposed to."
"Did you see a little girl on board?"
Tap, tap went her boot.
No, I'm sorry." He brightened. "They were Zunes," he said. "If the child was with them, she won't come to harm. You can always trust a Zune, they say, very keen on family life."
Granny turned to Hilter, who was fluttering like a bewildered butterfly, and raised her eyebrows.
"Oh, yes," Hilter trilled. "The Zunes have a very good name."
"Hm," said Granny. She turned on her heel and stumped back towards the centre of the town. The dockmaster sagged, as though a coat hanger had just been removed from his shirt. Hilter's lodgings were over a herbalist's and behind a tannery, and offered splendid views of the rooftops of O'Hoolan. She liked it because it offered privacy, always appreciated by, as she put it, "my more discerning clients, who prefer to make their special purchases in an atmosphere of calm, where discretion is forever the watchword." Granny Weatherwax looked around the sitting room with barely concealed scorn. There were altogether too many tassels, bead curtains, astrological charts and black cats in the place. Granny couldn't abide cats. She sniffed.
"Is that the tannery?"
she said accusingly.
"Incense," said Hilter.
She rallied bravely in the face of Granny's scorn.
"The custom was appreciated," she said. "It puts them in the right frame of mind. You know how it is." "I would have thought one could carry out a perfectly respectable business, Hilter, without resorting to parlour tricks,"
said Granny, sitting down and beginning the long and tricky business of removing her hat pins.
"It's different in towns," said Hilter. "One has to move with the times." "I'm sure I don't know why. Is the kettle on?"
Granny reached across the table and took the velvet cover off Hilter's crystal ball, a sphere of quartz as big as her head.
"Never could get the hang of this damn silicone stuff," she said. "A bowl of water with a drop of ink in it was good enough when I was a girl. Let's see now."
She peered into the dancing heart of the ball, trying to use it to focus her mind on the whereabouts of Esk. A crystal was a tricky thing to use at the best of times, and usually staring into it meant that the one thing the future could be guaranteed to hold was a severe migraine. Granny distrusted them, considering them to smack of wizardry. For two pins,
It almost seemed to her the wretched thing would suck your mind out like a whelk from a shell.
Damn thing's all sparkly, she said, huffing on it and wiping it with her sleeve.
Hilda peered over her shoulder.
That's not sparkle. That means something, she said slowly.
What?
I'm not sure. Can I try? It's used to me.
Hilda pushed the cat off the other chair and leaned forward to peer into the glass depths.
Feel free, said Granny. But you won't find...
Wait! Something's coming through.
Looks all sparkly here, Granny insisted. Little silver lights all floating around, like in them little snowstorms in a bottle toys. Quite pretty, really.
Yes, but look beyond the flakes.
Granny looked. This is what she saw. The viewpoint was very high up, and a wide swathe of country lay below her, blue with distance, through which a broad river wriggled like a drunken snake. There were silver lights floating in the foreground, but there were, in a manner of speaking, just a few flakes in the great storm of lights that had turned into a great lazy spiral, like a geriatric tornado with a bad attack of snow, and funneled down, down to the hazy landscape. By screwing up her eyes, Granny could just make out some dots on the river. Occasionally, some sort of lighting would sparkle briefly inside the gently turning funnel of motes. Granny blinked and looked up. The room seemed very dark.
Odd sort of weather,
she said, because she couldn't really think of anything better. Even with her eyes shut, the glittering moat still danced across her vision.
I don't think it's weather, said Hilda. I don't actually think people can see it, but the crystal shows it. I think it's magic, condensing out of the air.
Into the staff?
Yes, that's what a wizard's staff does. It sort of distills magic.
Granny risked another glance at the crystal.
Into-esque,
she said carefully.
Yes.
There looks quite a lot of it.
Yes.
Not for the first time, Granny wished she knew more about how wizards work their magic. She had a vision of Esk filling up with magic until every tissue and pore was bloated with the stuff. Then it would start leaking, slowly at first, arcing to the ground in little bursts, but then building up to a great discharge of occult potentiality. It could do all kinds of damage.
Drat, she said. I never did like that staff.
At least she's heading towards the university place, said Hilda. They'll know what to do.
That says maybe. How far downriver do you reckon they are?
20 miles or so. Those barges only go at walking pace. The Zoons aren't in any hurry.
Right.
Granny stood up, her jaw set defiantly. She reached for her hat and picked up her sack of possessions.
Reckon I can walk faster than a barge, she said. The river's all bendy, but I can go in straight lines.
You're going to walk after her, said Hilda aghast. But there's forests and wild animals.
Good. I could do with getting back to civilization. She needs me. That staff is taking over. I said it would, but did anyone listen?
Did they? Said Hilda,
still trying to work out what Granny meant by getting back to civilization.
No,
said Granny coldly.